heat events ever witnessed on the planet. Unfortunately, we can expect more of that as global temperatures warm.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex returns with Dr. Chris Callahan on heat deaths in Europe.
Many European countries have aging populations, including France, Germany, Italy, and Spain. What does that mean as more extreme heat arrives?
Typically, we observe that the people that are victims of extreme heat events tend to be elderly people. These are people with potentially more pre-existing health problems or who may be more vulnerable to extreme conditions in general. Our study didn't explicitly consider how different age groups are affected differently. In general, though, there is good evidence that as populations age, we do get more and more vulnerability to heat.
According to a 2024 study by Kai Chen and colleagues, heat deaths double when global mean temperature goes from 1.5 degrees to 2 degrees C of warming, and getting 2 degrees seems pretty likely, and then with growing emissions, 3 degrees C of warming is possible by the end of this century or before, and at 3 degrees of warming, they found deaths are 5 times higher than current heat waves at 1.5 degrees. Does that fit in with your findings, and is global warming kind of a threat multiplier?
I think it is correct to call it a threat multiplier. One thing that we see is that the relationship between heat exposure and mortality risk is nonlinear, meaning every additional degree creates greater and greater risk. The hotter you are, the more each additional degree creates additional exposure and impacts. And so the more we see temperatures rise, the more we should expect each additional increase in greenhouse gas emissions to be more and more dangerous.
Why do you say even 4 degrees C of global warming is plausible if we try gradual decarbonization? That surprised me a bit.
I think it's important to clarify that in general, in this study, we're looking at global temperatures on an annual basis, not a long-term basis. So in general, the current prediction is that we are likely to end up at around 2.8 degrees Celsius of global warming by the end of the century if current emissions policies are maintained. What previous evidence has shown is that if you end up in a climate that's around 2.8 degrees Celsius, you can have additional individual years that are potentially warmer than 3 degrees Celsius because of the sort of random variability of year-to-year temperatures. So I do not think it is particularly likely that we get an individual year that is 4 degrees Celsius warmer than pre-industrial conditions, but even if we don't end up in a 4 degrees Celsius climate, it's still possible to have individual 4 degrees Celsius years.
What if weather becomes more stabilized in a warming world, perhaps as the oceans get more stable and they heat up relatively evenly, so we don't get an event like the 2003 heat wave in Europe, or at least not in this century? Is that plausible?
It's definitely possible that climate change will alter atmospheric circulation and weather patterns in pretty complex ways. This is still an ongoing active area of research, and I don't think we have a clear scientific consensus on this yet. And in fact, our study didn't really look at this question. The only question we were asking was, if these weather patterns recur, what would be their effects? But it's certainly important for the scientific community to figure out if it is possible for them to occur. But the uncertainty on that projection right now is extremely high.
And work by Noah Diffenbaugh and Elizabeth Barnes suggests global warming will drive even more extreme heat waves beyond anything seen in recorded history. What do you think, Chris?
I think that extreme heat is one of the signal impacts of climate change. We know with near absolute certainty that every degree of global warming gives us increases in the intensity and frequency of extreme heat events. And so as long as we continue emitting greenhouse gases, we should expect these extreme heat waves to continue getting more frequent and more intense.
It sounds to me like more and more of people's time and the global economy will be devoted just to surviving the changes in heat. We try to keep the civilization going during hotter and longer lasting heat waves. Does your research convince you heat survival will become a basic preoccupation in coming decades?
I think it depends on who you are looking at. I do think that heat survival will be a central concern for lower income people and people who have to work outside. If you are an outdoor worker, a farm worker, someone who works in the open air in some way, you absolutely need to be worried about how you're going to manage your exposure to very hot conditions during the summer. Absolutely.
Chris, take a little time and tell us, what are you working on now?
I'm interested in thinking about the future risk of similar extreme heat events and how we might use our statistical tools to analyze those future events if they occur beyond anything we've currently experienced. We might see extreme heat events that are in any individual region worse than anything that individual region has experienced historically. And so how do we analyze and understand those events given that much of our understanding of climate change is based on our historical experience? So I'm really interested in this tension between needing to prepare for future unprecedented extreme events and the difficulties that those unprecedented events pose for both social and scientific systems.
From the Paul H. O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, we've been speaking with Dr. Chris Callahan. He leads the article, Increasing Risk of Mass Human Heat Mortality of Historical Weather Patterns Record. And it was published November 18th in Nature Climate Change. You can check it out. I'll put links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Chris, thank you for this.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Yes, yes.
Light taker.
Oh, yeah.
Empty out.
Everything.
Got a mortgage on my heart. Got me stumbling from the start. Storm maker, heartbreaker. All parents. All the underworld promising the dawn.
Oh, yeah.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Are you getting less freezing and more heat stress? How does that affect your energy bill? A new technique analyzing hourly weather reveals a lot about this. The team combed through 46 years of American weather records to find critical changes. Dr. Sandra Uter used her 30 years of experience with meteorological hardware and big data dumps to find trends in a lot of weather records. Sandra has her PhD in atmospheric sciences. She is distinguished professor of environmental analytics at North Carolina State University. From Raleigh, North Carolina, Sandra Uter, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, Alex. Pleasure to be here.
There are all kinds of record keeping for daily temperatures. We see that all the time. What inspired your team to look deeper into the details of the hours?
So the reason why a lot of the climate information that we get is based on daily information is that most of the record only has daily temperatures. So that's the minimum and maximum and sometimes the average. It's only been in the last few decades, so since about the late 1970s, and in the U.S., we routinely recorded hourly observations. There were a few stations that had some hourly observations actually back to the 40s and 50s, but not too many. And so I guess there was a couple of motivations for this. One was when I talked to kind of the general public, my neighbors, I have students in a freshman class, and I tell them, temperatures are going up by 1 to 2 degrees Celsius. They pretty much sort of shrug and say, it doesn't seem like a big deal to me. But yet, if you've lived in a place for a while, you've probably noticed that things have been changing, but you can't quite articulate it. And so we thought that by looking at the hourly data, that we could sort of dig deeper and get better information about a couple of key thresholds that actually matter to people. So, for example, if it's 15 degrees Celsius, let's say that's about 59 degrees Fahrenheit, and, you know, the temperature goes up by 2 degrees to 17 Celsius or 62.6, you probably wouldn't even notice much. But if you cross a temperature threshold, like if you were below freezing and now you're above freezing, or if this 30 degrees Celsius temperature threshold, which is 86 Fahrenheit, is the threshold for heat stress where you really start feeling the physical effects. Those are noticeable, impactful thresholds. And so we thought by looking at the hourly data, we'd get a much better picture of those changes associated with those thresholds.
Yeah, this is the way humans experience weather. We don't experience a daily average. We're going through it hour by hour. And I love your list of ways weather can significantly shift in just an hour. Can you give us some examples?
One that I think most people will resonate with is if a thunderstorm goes through. So say it's like a very hot day in the summer, and then a thunderstorm goes through, right? It gets more cloudy. Often there's rainfall, which then cools the temperatures. And so within a matter of minutes, the temperatures could drop. So this makes a big difference in terms of energy usage and comfort. So, for example, if that thunderstorm happens in the middle of the afternoon, where it's already been pretty hot, and now we've sort of got this couple of degree temperature relief, that's a big deal because in terms of the energy use. But if that same storm goes through in the middle of the night, you're less likely to notice it, and it's not going to make such a difference for energy use.
Weather records seem to self-define into three large regional groups in the continental U.S., according to your study. Could you introduce us to those regions and maybe a little bit of what sets them apart?
Basically, we've got, you could almost divide the U.S. into thirds, sort of the western portion, so west of the Rocky Mountains, then the middle portion, and then the eastern portion, which would be sort of the Mississippi to the coast. And so what we're seeing is different climate trends in these threshold temperatures based on the areas. So in the East Coast, particularly the Northeast, the bigger changes in climate have actually been in winter. And I think we don't hear about it so much on the news because if there's, you know, a bit more warm spells, right, nobody's going to the hospital. People are just like, okay, well, maybe I don't need such a heavy coat. But we've actually seen more changes in the winter than in the summer. And that's in terms of the number of hours below freezing. So we're essentially losing winter faster than we're getting changes in the summer. So in the, particularly the Northeast U.S., we've lost about 1.5 to 2 weeks equivalent of temperatures below freezing. And so this makes a big difference in terms of whether we're getting rain or snow at the surface. It obviously makes a big difference if you own a ski resort or trying to go skiing. It also makes a big difference for things like invasive insects because they, you know, when it's cold and freezing, that sort of helps mitigate their spread. In the West, and particularly the Southwest, we're seeing more changes in terms of higher temperatures. Those temperatures where we're above that heat stress threshold of 30 degrees Celsius or 86 degrees Fahrenheit. And then in the middle, it's actually quite interesting because there aren't clear trends. Instead, what there is a lot of variability. So I think understanding these differences, I mean, the U.S. is a big country. It's not surprising there are differences. You know, right, everybody's familiar, there's a huge difference in the climate between Florida and North Dakota. But understanding how this then affects people's decisions about how to adapt. The problem with the Midwest is without a clear trend, you can get a lot of different outcomes year to year. And that's harder to adapt to than if, for example, you're knowing that you're going to have a lot more hotter temperatures in the summer, or if you're going to have sort of milder winters in the East Coast.
I wonder if that variability leads to people in the Midwest being less sure that climate change is happening because they don't experience it as directly as, say, somebody in New England who can't get any ice rinks to freeze anymore because their winter's too warm. They know something's different.
Yeah, I think this is a really good point, and I've actually been wondering about it myself. I think here, like in North Carolina, I was talking to a colleague, and he was saying about his 90-year-old neighbor was talking about how they used to skate on a pond in a nearby park. And, like, for us, that's, like, unthinkable. That would never happen. But, again, if you're in the Midwest and, like, some years it is quite cold, frigid, and other years it's warmer, I think, yeah, it's, as I said, it's related to the lived experience. And so your lived experience, if you're in the Midwest, is, well, it just all seems very variable, you know, and I think it's harder for them to necessarily see because where they're not experiencing it.
The data used in this study is truly solid. It comes from 340 stations with continuous reporting from 1978 to 2023. But the measurements do come from airports, though. Does that matter? Could it miss even hotter temperatures deep in cities?
I guess the airports matter for a couple of reasons. One is, if you think about from the late 1970s till now, a lot of urban areas have expanded. So when a lot of these airports were built, they were kind of probably on the outskirts of cities, and now they're probably closer or maybe even, you know, incorporated into the built-up areas. And so there is a bit of an urban heat island effect, which would tend to make the temperatures a bit warmer than, say, the surrounding rural areas. But our thinking in the paper was that this is part of what people experience. We are not only seeing the outcomes of changes in temperature due to increased greenhouse gases, but we're also seeing changes in temperature associated with building out of asphalt and buildings and replacing, you know, more green and forested areas with more built up. And so in terms of, again, what people actually experience, that's part of it.
You also captured data from Canadian weather records, at least in southern Canada. What did you find out about changes in freezing or heat for our Canadian listeners?
So basically the general patterns in terms of the Midwest and the more southern central Canada versus more eastern Canada, those patterns are similar to what we see in the U.S. with, again, a lack of trends more in the Great Lakes areas. And then as we move further east, a more clear trend about losing time with temperatures below 0 degrees C.
And your group found hourly temperature trends can reflect in energy use. I found that very interesting. You find most of the U.S. encounters fewer hours needing heating in winter, but more cooling degree hours in summer. Does that winter warming savings cancel out energy demand in summer for air conditioning?
So it depends on the region. So in the northern parts of the U.S. and in southern Canada, because of the more warm spells in the winter, we're actually saving energy, and that savings is more than the additional cost of the higher temperatures in the summer. If we go to the western U.S. and the southwestern U.S., it's reversed in the sense that we are spending more money to cool on those hot days, and that the warming in the winter is not enough to offset it. So it sort of depends. It's a regional thing. And again, in the Midwest, it's variable. And so if you're in a utility, this is a problem in the sense that you have to anticipate a wider range of temperatures and energy use. Whereas in the northern part of the U.S., you can anticipate that your energy load is going to be less in the winter.
Sandra Uter, your team found a lot of different possible applications for hourly weather trends. Can you give us some examples of who can use this?
Well, I think there's a variety of groups of people. I mean, one of our sort of key, hopefully, people that would take this information is state, local governments, even businesses, in terms of what would they do to adapt for changes in the next 10 to 20 years. Because often the resources are limited. So you want to prioritize. Also, do you want to invest a lot of money in shade for, let's say, your city center? Those, I would argue that, you know, particularly in the Southwest and the West, that's a high priority. It may not be such a high priority in places like the Northeast, because while it does happen on some days, it's less of an issue. Also, if you are in the agricultural sector, I think, and you're worried about your livestock outside, you know, again, are you going to invest in cooling in the summer, or are you going to invest, you know, does it make sense? Are you worried about, like, the warming of your farm animal sheds? And then also things like, again, invasive insects. What are those risks? So I think particularly here on the East Coast with less cold winters, invasive insects are more of a concern.
I wonder if this technique of hourly approaches could be expanded to some other fields. For example, flash floods and sudden torrential rainfall seem to have increased in recent decades. Do you think that could hold promise with your technique?
I think it's different with flooding because often we're looking at an accumulation of hourly rain. So if I particularly look at when we had the very bad Hurricane Helene here last fall in North Carolina, a lot of the reason why those rivers flooded so quickly was because there was a storm before Hurricane Helene came that had already made the ground quite wet and already raised the levels of the river. And so then Helene on top of that really was, you know, led to extraordinarily bad flooding. It's different with precipitation because you're sort of building up the stream level in the rivers over multiple hours and multiple days rather than having like a very heavy rain in 1 hour.
Although we have heard of some very heavy rains in 1 or 2 hours, a foot recently happened in Vietnam, as a matter of fact. So how can this new hourly view help communicate the reality and direction of climate change to the public?
Basically by focusing on thresholds that have clear impacts like freezing and heat stress, which are basically helping people understand impacts that will matter to them personally in terms of their day-to-day activities and the infrastructure that they use. And I think it's just easier to relate to than just sort of a general, oh, the temperatures are going up by 2 degrees. Because when you hear 2 degrees, you know, I think people just, you know, kind of shrug and say, yeah, it doesn't seem like a big deal to me. So you want to be thinking about it in terms of when you cross these key thresholds and what the impacts are.
So you got your doctorate in 1996, but you appear to have co-authored a paper in 1981. Did I get that right? And if so, how did that happen? How did you get going as a young scientist?
So I was very fortunate as an undergraduate working with James Head at Brown University in planetary geology. Yeah, this was actually one of the key experiences in my life that led me to be a scientist, is that I was able to get a summer job in his laboratory working with data related to the topographic features on the planet Venus. So he was funded by NASA to use this data from a new satellite, and I participated in the data analysis. And my contribution was sufficient that the other professors who were on the paper basically decided that it was worthy of a co-authorship.
And now, after a lot of peer-reviewed studies, you've authored or co-authored, and some are very technical. What are you working on these days, Sandra?
We're working on a number of different things, but one of the things that I'm actually most excited about is we're trying to get a better understanding of cloud dissipation. So as in atmospheric science, we have a pretty good idea about why clouds form, but we're not so good at the sort of end of the life cycle, about exactly what is the time scale and processes associated when clouds go away. And so we've developed some new instrumentation to help us study this at relatively, at timescales of a few minutes and spatial scales of tens of meters to kind of fill in some gaps of our understanding. Most of our data on clouds right now comes from satellite, and so it's a bit coarse, usually multiple kilometers, and often we don't, you know, depending on the satellite, the timescale could be minutes, hours to days between the different pictures. The other problem with satellite is that because it's looking down on the Earth, if there's multiple levels of a cloud, then it only sees the topmost one. And so we've developed some ground-based instrumentation to look at low clouds, so basically looking upwards. And so this is giving us some new insights into how these low clouds form and then how they dissipate. And as you might anticipate, this has big implications for things like solar energy. When a cloud goes over a solar insolation, the amount of solar energy that comes in drops, and it actually can drop over periods of minutes, so it can be very variable. So, and also it's related to things like, you know, the surface temperature. So that's some of the stuff that we're working on right now.
I've probably talked to 24 scientists who said clouds are the last real frontier of unknown, and they can determine what kind of climate future we're going to experience, whether we get more clouds and when we get them and where they form. So I think you're working on something really important there.
Okay, well, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, we're often trying to figure out where the gaps are and where I particularly focus on observations, where new observations can help us fill in those gaps.
From North Carolina State University, we've been speaking with Distinguished Professor Sandra Uter. Find links and notes to all the science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Sandra, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Record-setting typhoons and atmospheric rivers are directly due to ocean heating in a greenhouse world and the vapor-loaded warmer air. Very large systems are changing. A study published last February found extreme precipitation in southern China shot up 10 times previous amounts over the previous decade. That is astounding and very hard on people in China. I ask you to become global citizens. Look beyond the news filter to see big changes going on in the real world. The oceans and atmosphere are all connected to your own weather, economy, and society. There is no other side of the world. Just one small planet, your planet. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring. Let's meet up again next week.
Now for something completely different.
When the screen cracks, nature shapeshifts, gradual violence building into superstorms and fire. Quick, find shelter in your love. This universe, they say, all of it and everything is contained in a black hole. The infinite has limits. When it all twists out of shape, court houses and palaces sinking into the ground we left void. Quick, find shelter in your love. When it all goes crazy as a part, how can I not? New flexible rulers shrink and grow, no way to measure anything to geolocate where I stand. Go on. Set your mind to standard time, but minutes are shorter now. Hours longer, days uncertain, faulty artificial thought, misdirected into lives in shallow sounding. The ship of state runs aground, citizen witness to the passing of something great. Nuclear razors hiding underneath vainglorious struggles, earth predators past the peak. past the funeral wire, still joy,
joy
is ready to surprise. Life in the cloud.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.